that you would like us, that you would just like us to discuss. So you can, I'm suggesting that you send me that in a private chat. I mean, if you send it to everyone, it's not the end of the world. But if you just send it to, you know, Brightways and Doan in chat, then I can see them. And then those in the Zendo, I'll hand out pads of paper. And you can, if you have something that you would like us to discuss, and I don't get through all of these in one day, but then it gives me a good sense of what you'd like me to talk about in the near future. So I'll give you 5 minutes or so. Okay, so I'm going to rename myself. So screw up Doan's in the future. But so a couple of people messaged the cart instead of me. So if you wouldn't mind, I got Benny's question. But if you want to Looks like John and John Butler. John, you want to send your question to me instead of the Doan? But look at all these questions. Yay.
Thank you.
All right. All right, so there's one question about the Surangama Sutra. I'm not going to be covering that one today. We'll see. Let's see. So where to begin? I guess I will just take the first question that popped up. What about love and compassion in Zen? Because although there is pure compassion in the Bodhisattva vow and so on, sometimes Zen feels kind of cold to me. So I wonder if, I don't know, like the person who asked the question can pipe up, but maybe other folks too. If you have at times perceived Zen as being kind of cold, in what way? Like, how does that manifest? Jinryu.
Well, this is kind of related to my question. So I get to get my question out there. But I remember it was this past January, and we were encouraged to cultivate deep thought. And it was said on three different Sundays in a row. And so my question is, what about cultivating empathy? What about cultivating compassion? Especially when Dogen tells us, you don't have to worry about being dull or sharp-witted. So I don't know if that is helpful to what this person asked, but when we get heavily intellectual, it's interesting. But if I have taken a vow to free everyone, I always think of the single mother with two kids holding down two jobs. Now, how does that person cultivate deep thought when, in fact, empathy and compassion seem to me to be the rule?
Yes. So I would take that as where sometimes the apparent kind of lack of emphasis on compassion seems to be, like, sometimes our study or our focus seems to be rather intellectual instead of focusing on specifically cultivating compassion or manifesting compassion. Brian.
Well, I don't know how Zen missed this, but it would have swept the world if it had a better name, which should have been de-gunkification. So I think that part of if you can de-gunkify, sort of get out of your own way, and it's easier to empathize and connect with, understand, and give of yourself, I think, to others. And the second thing, because I used to wrestle with this a lot in grammar school and high school, and that's sometimes there's an objectification of love in that I found in Christianity that sort of subtly became how to be good. You know, you sort of have this obligation to be this way, and this is to do this thing called love, and that's how you're good. And so subtly the aspiration becomes to be good. And I think that's also an interior focus that ends up dividing you from someone that you would love or care about or empathize with and so forth. So anyway, in degunkification is not trademarked. It's not branded. If you want to use it, you can just go for it.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Betty.
Yeah, this is a interesting question. And your question back at us was, what do you feel when you feel that way? So for me, in my attempt to take a pause before I react, so that I can work on skillful action, I work on letting go of whatever my attachment is to whatever's happening or my own responses. And so sometimes that letting go of attachment turns to detachment, which turns to apathy. And it's at that point that I feel like I've lost my sort of compassion and love piece of the practice. Anyway, that's my own feeling on that.
And I would phrase that in another way, maybe what seems like an emphasis on equanimity, you know, that kind of at the cost of like warm-hearted response. Benny.
Yeah, I would say the same. So this equanimity thing, you know, this for me, it was the same when I really started getting into the Zen thing. It tended more to the unemotional. I don't know why it's that way, but maybe it's this, you know, initial will to have something under control. Or something like this, but it was like this. And now I am feeling like for 2 months or something that it's opening up, that I'm really discovering more and more the full-heartedness and compassion in this whole then thing. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, it's all about all about that. But I don't know, even when we talk about the then topics in the then style, it's in compared with other things I'm doing spiritually, it's more intellectual, like you said before, like Brian said. And with that, for me, it feels like there's this coldness.
Yes. It's very interesting because it's true when you, when you look at any path, right? So it could be different Buddhist paths. There are very different Buddhist paths from Zen. You know, look at different spiritual traditions. They all have their strengths and their weaknesses, right? So I think it is probably true that Zen errs on the side of cultivating equanimity, you know, dealing with ourselves, degunkification, because then it gets out of the way of our compassion. So we do a lot of self-study and that's supposedly going to free up the compassion. And when you compare our scenario, right, with, you know, a Christian church or something, and you know, with song and sentiment and, you know, people like encouraging you to come again and all that kind of stuff. Like it touches something different, you know, it has a more emotional, warm tone, which, you know, especially Japanese inspired Zen, you know, we're dang like warm and friendly compared to many Zen groups, right? So at least when you come in, we're going to look you in the eye and we're going to say, welcome. But a lot of places might be very, you know, just now we're entering a space of silence for the kind of contemplation and everybody would be in black robes and all that stuff. I think for me, it feels like, you know, the Buddhist tradition made its choices based on a distrust of what do I want to say? A distrust of sentiment, a distrust of emotions to some extent. For many of us before practice, or people who don't practice or whatever, like our emotions tell our truth. If I am angry, anger is my truth. If I am passionately lusting after a coworker, even though I'm married, dang, that's my truth. You know, like, so we end up getting pulled around by, intoxicated by our emotions, which are just, you know, thoughts with, you know, juiced up thoughts. So, you know, Buddhism from the beginning has been like, cool it, you know, cool it. This is just something that arises and passes, the thoughts, the emotions. So we're starting to disidentify with all of that, which is actually a really good thing, right? Because most of that emotion is very self-centered, even if we think it's not, right? Our love for our spouse is really about, they got to return that love. And you know, our selfishness is very wrapped up, even in, you know, our love relationships, usually, if we haven't examined them. So we're asked to really, yeah, to kind of step back and disidentify and degunkify. And then, but then, like, the idea is that our hearts open up, right? And maybe we don't emphasize this enough. I don't know. I mean, I got podcast episodes on the divine abidings, you know, compassion and empathy and sympathetic joy. Equanimity is only one of those. I have episodes on Dogen's, like, the four methods of a bodhisattva, the, you know, giving and identity, you know, being in the same boat with other beings. So I think you're listening to a podcast, or I'm giving a talk about it, right? And we're kind of like, that's very interesting. Do you have any questions about that? So I guess our way is a little intellectual as opposed to maybe more experiential or something. I don't know. I guess for me, you know, there is a lot of emphasis on our self-work before we're trying to feel a lot of compassion and manifest a lot of compassion. Although we do focus on the precepts a lot. So that is very much about relationship and getting out of the way and not using other people and stuff like that. So I don't know. I guess Zen has never felt, it's never felt cold to me. Even though, like I said, I can see these comparisons that, you know, maybe not that warm or emotional sometimes, but it's always been for me about moving toward, like, the greatest possible intimacy. To me, that, you know, when I think about what I want to awaken to and what I want to embody, it's like intimacy with every last thing, right? Every situation, every last thing I encounter, not to mention people, like, of course, people. You know, I think there is a maybe one place where Zen and Buddhism really do lack is, like, all right, maybe your heart is open, but now what, right? Like, the manifestation of compassion in the world in terms of, like, service and activism and, you know, okay, we've done the self-study, now let's get out there and actually do something. But, I mean, I guess to give some benefit of the doubt to various Zen centers, we're kind of counting on y'all out there doing that, right? In your families, in your jobs, in the course of your daily life, that you are putting this into action. Oh, that's some of my reflections. Somebody had your hand up. Was it Veronica?
Yeah, I had my hand up, but then you kind of answered it. I was just going to say that, like, what brought me to Buddhism was the Dalai Lama, just like as a public figure. And he's always, my perception is, he's often answering questions in public saying that the solution is to think less of yourself. Like, he says that so often. He's always telling less people, the problem is you're thinking too much of yourself. You must think more of other people. And I just love that message. And then I found Zen, but nothing in Zen is opposed to that. I think it like learning how to manage my own emotions and my own thoughts helps me to think of myself less. So I do think it does come back to the same message, just in a different way. So, but you said that already. So,
although it does occur to me though, that like part of our practice is, I mean, we work on our insight and we work on our karma, right? So like it's, they're not mutually exclusive. So actually, really actually trying to cultivate open-heartedness and generosity and compassion, even if you haven't degunkified, right? That actually teaches you, that actually shows you where the gunk is, right? As you are trying to be kind and generous. I don't know. And that habit of profound thought, I feel like that's what we can apply also to this. And a matter of fact, I was just, came up for me in Zazen today. I was on a mass transit the other day, and our mass transit in Portland has gotten quite colonized by people with mental illness and without homes. And I was sitting, many rows away. There wasn't crowded at that point. And some guy got on who was muttering to himself. He sat down. Then he started walking up and down the aisles. And he kept walked by me several times. And he had his pants down around his hips in kind of the style, but he also had his hand down there. And then, so at some point after the second time he passed me, I got up and moved up several rows to sit by where some other guy was, which no guarantee that he would be of any help, but anyway. And then the muttering guy said, like, "Why are you moving, sister?" So he started getting, but then he let it go. But part of me, it came up, like, so if he hadn't let it go and he had come to confront me, my internal response is kind of like, I would let the anger out, right? Be like, which probably is not a good idea in the situation. I mean, it probably is just going to antagonize him even more, blah, blah, blah. So like studying, like what is a truly authentic, compassionate response there? And not just compassionate, but also skillful. Like not just what would be my authentic response, but like, what would actually be helpful? I don't know. I don't know, but I actually, because I took Aikido for a while, right? And when you go like this, you create conflict on the other side, right? So what would have been a response that keeps me, sets my boundary, but doesn't do like, man, you shouldn't even be here and you shouldn't be doing that. And I don't know. I mean, it just occurred to me, 2020 hindsight, right? Doesn't come up in the moment. In the moment, you're just like, but maybe I'm saying, because you're scaring me. I don't know. That would be, that would be honest, actually make me a little vulnerable, but also like, this is a human being and I'm not just going to fight with you. I'm going to say, your actions are scaring me. You can argue with me that you didn't mean to scare me, but that sounds like a positive conversation, right? Anyway, I think this is a rich area of contemplation. Judith.
So this is Tales of the ER, where at San Francisco General Hospital, where you're confronted constantly as a health professional with people coming in and what you learn immediately. And this is why Zen practice is important to me, I think, because it sort of got tested out there. You show up when you're new and you're standing at a desk, let's just say you're in the psych area. So all the homeless people with psych problems are brought in by the cops, and you receive them, and the first person thinks you're an angel, and you're like,
oh, I'm a nurse, I'm an angel.
And then the next person that shows up thinks you're the devil himself, herself. And this just goes on, and you are offended. Mm. But after a while, after about a month, you start to get a grip on your reaction to that. You see that it's just, you know, I mean, maybe you are both those things, but still, everyone has a different take on who you are. So you eventually just stand there. It's sort of like just sitting. I mean, you keep a straight face, and then if you talk, you try to say something reassuring, but not too engaging. You just become neutral. Mm-hmm. And it is the most helpful thing to do. So I don't know how that fits in with, but I certainly understand your position on the train. Yeah,
and that's like really is about what is our motivation? Because honestly, many of us approach spiritual practice, including Zen, for selfish reasons, right? We want more equanimity so we don't feel as upset and, you know, feel such painful emotions or whatever. We want more equanimity for ourselves. But within the context of the divine abidings, equanimity is for the sake of others. Mm-hmm. We usually think of equanimity as being like, kind of like, well, I don't care, you know, like indifference, right? The near enemy is indifference. But actually, you know, same with like parenting, right? If your kid hates you and is angry at you and whatever, you have to be able to kind of hold that, be bigger than that, have a bigger perspective and not respond with anger. So the equanimity then actually makes that space for the compassion and the empathy and the, all that. Any other
thank you
thoughts? Oh yeah, go ahead, Ruth.
Thank you, Domio, for thank you for this and sharing your mass transit stories. I've had a couple of those. About 5 years ago, when I knew I was looking for a spiritual practice in an everyday way, I wasn't going to depend on the computer for me. It just, even though, you know, there are good podcasts and everything out there, but one time I accidentally watched Thich Nhat Hanh giving a talk, as he did Kin Hin, and I was shocked when he said, well, to our Zen friends, whatever it is you're working on, dozing off or whatever, fight the no fight. And I just, I mean, that can mean anything, but I just find that I love a challenge, and that's what the Zen format is to me. Japanese culture is formal, and I just find simplicity. If I lived another 78 years, I would be working on the same factors in my practice, and that's okay.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it does. It does make me think of. I similarly like hold the Dalai Lama in my head as just like the most warm, compassionate, generous person that I can summon an image of, and I once had, you know, in terms of like what Betty was talking about, this feeling a little bit like when we practice, maybe we're kind of distancing ourselves a little bit, or we're letting go of attachments or getting too excited about material things or whatever it is, then so sometimes practice can kind of undermine our natural empathy or sympathetic joy for people. Like, oh my God, that's so great that you won all that money. Like, you know, kind of like, well, you know, but I think one of the greatest descriptions of sympathetic joy that I've found is by Edward Konza. And he talks about how it takes a rare, like a truly broad heart, open soul to be happy. He said, be happy for the children of the world and what makes them happy. Like to really just, that's great. And for me, this manifested with like way back when Toyota Priuses were brand new. And a friend of mine, he was on the wait list and oh my God, he finally got it. And he came into the Zen Center and he was like, it's outside. Like, oh, and he was all excited about it. And he wanted us to come out and see. And I'm kind of like, oh, you know, material possessions, a new car, like really, does this have, you know, whatever. And, you know, but I went out and I like looked at it. Okay, that's great. And look at the screen. And then like, but then afterwards, you know, that didn't quite feel right. And I just imagine like, what would the Dalai Lama do, right? The Dalai Lama would be just like, oh, wow, can I sit in it? That's great. Great. You know, just like that. So I think of that sometimes, like, I don't know. For me, at the beginning of practice, even if I had that idea in my head, like Brian was talking about, like I should be like this kind of person, feeling compassion and love and generosity, but I didn't really, like, it was very constrained. Mostly I was just thinking about myself and my inadequacies and my suffering and what I wanted and all that. But it's like over the course of practice, it's like the focus went from here. And as I had more and more energy, it was like, oh, look at all these people. Hey guys, what what have you been up to? Like I suddenly noticed. I'm not all focused on myself, right? I can notice other people and therefore notice maybe what they need or what they're saying or be interested in what they're saying, etc. So for me, it's like, even if it might not seem obvious, it's definitely led toward that more open-heartedness. Vin.
Well, just to emphasize what you just said, but earlier you had said that you thought it was perhaps not ideal that we come to Zen Buddhism out of selfish goals. And I think it's actually highly desirable, given that we're humans, and if there's nothing in it for us, it's hard for us to continue starting off. And, you know, I can say personally, I've been watching, reading recently about the differences between empathy, sympathy, and compassion in a Buddhist sense. And I came to Buddhism to get away from sympathy that I found to be exhausting and paralyzing. A lot of bad things happen in the world. I tend to notice them. And then I do nothing about it because I'm upset about it. And the upset is paralyzing. And Buddhism gives at least the option of generating compassion, which is a more positive emotion and an impetus to action. And given my value structure, action's more important than feeling. So I'll stop rambling now.
Thank you. All right. Well, I have a whole bunch of questions here. This is great. But I do There's one in the chat that I think I'd tackle next, which I imagine other Sangha members might have some wisdom to share here. How to decide whether to tell very Catholic family members about Zen. So most of us, I mean, I would say almost all of us are converts to Buddhism. We weren't raised in Buddhism. What's very interesting is we actually do have a growing generation now of people who did actually grow up in a Buddhist household. The children of converts. So, you know, obviously there's still many communities, ethnic communities and stuff where that is, they have their own temple and stuff, but there's not a lot of crossover. So a lot of times Zen centers are just a bunch of mostly white people who are converts to Buddhism. So we end up having families or significant others who are not involved. And how to, you know, I think I have a podcast episode on this. In some ways, well, probably the hardest is if you have devout family members who are very attached, sounds negative, but they're very attached to their tradition. And so therefore, you know, if you choose a different tradition, that is alienating and might be threatening or very confusing at the least. It's also difficult, like what I had was a pretty much completely non-religious family. So frankly, people who got involved in religion are whack jobs. So, you know, so then you have that aspect of it, which is like, I don't know, like letting my parents know that, you know, I had a black robe for going to meditate in this, you know, meditation hall, and I, you know, did bows to statues, and I don't know, like, so yeah. I guess it's a very complex question, but and I do want other Sangha members to chime in here, but I guess my take-home message about that is what our family members generally care about the most, if you have a decent relationship, is their relationship with us. So really, what they care about is how does this change my relationship with you? And so trying to reassure family members that this is just a positive thing, it's not crazy, you know, not trying to go too weird and overboard about it, at least not too quickly, you know, trying to set our family members at ease that they are not going to lose us, that we're not going crazy, that we haven't joined a cult, whatever. And I know that I really wanted my family to understand when I first got involved. Well, actually, when I first got involved, they didn't care because it was just like a hobby. But when I wanted to get ordained, now I was going into some weird territory. So I wanted to explain, right? I wanted to explain Zen, and I wanted to make the case. And like, it just did not seem to help at all. They seemed to be totally uninterested. And and my sister let me have it. She was basically, we don't care. We don't care about Zen. We only care about our relationship with you. So I don't know, not all families are gonna be like that. But then I backed off the explanation because I knew I wanted them to understand, but that was not possible. At first, this wasn't something that I was going to be able to share with them, but over many, many, many years after they came to my wedding that took place in a Zen center, and thereby they had to, you know,
be surrounded by Zen people and all that, you know, they could see all right. So over the years, they've become much more familiar with it and supportive of it, which is sweet. Other, anybody? Yeah, James. And then Jason.
Yeah, I'm one of the 99.9% of later in life converts with a family that has mostly my oldest son, or my son, I only have one son, has been raised now. Half of his life has been spent with me practicing, and the previous half was not. My daughter, her experience is this is what I do because I've been practicing since she was born. And it's interesting to see the differences in there, the way they see the world based on how I influence them pre-practice and after practice. Mm. And Xander's got a little more, you know, he's got a little more of an edge to him, but he's a really good, you know, so he's like half and half. And Anjali is just like pure love and delight and joy and openness, you know, so because and I don't know if that my practice has had anything to do with that, but I'm definitely a different person since then. But as far as family members go, I've got distant relatives that are such hardcore fundamentalist Christians that when Great Vow was moving into the Klatskanai place, the aunt wrote a letter in protest that these demon worshipers were coming into her area because she lives up in that area. Yeah, so I've got that extreme. And my approach with her is it doesn't even come up. We don't go there. You know, they know better than to get all super Jesus on me. And I know better than to say anything at all about Buddhism with them. But then I've got like my mother-in-law is, you know, she's been a Presbyterian for all of her life. She's the organist at the old Scotch church. And she's been there for 20, you know, 30, 40 years, whatever. But there's just such a warm, open-minded kind of community that even the pastor of that church is like, so how's your practice going? How's the Zen thing going? You know, so everybody's like super cool. And then my dad, who was an Assemblies of God minister, but then now he rejects Christianity and he's into Taoism and a little bit, like he loves it, you know? So it's just like this mixture. But the only thing that I could say in that question of, well, how do you talk to family members about Zen is I don't. I try to just be an example, just lead by example, just be present as I am with the practice influencing my life to whatever degree it is. And then if somebody asks me about it, then sure, I'll open up. But I not that I'm anywhere close to the level of Buddha, but I know, and that was like the Buddha's original Shakyamuni Buddha, that was the way he approached a lot of his teachings. Like, and now there's still in some of those communities, you don't even speak about the Dharma, like in the Theravadan community, you don't give a teaching, you don't speak about the Dharma at all unless you're asked, and you just stay silent and you're an example until somebody approaches you. So I guess the short answer to how do you talk to family members about Zen is I don't. you just be you and let them come to you, I guess. That would be my recommendation. But
yeah. And I noticed it's very rare for me, anyway, my experience, that friends or family really ask. And when they ask, they really don't want you to go on about it very much. Right? They want a little snippet, and then that's good. You know, like, you know, we'd like to talk about our practice and this thing that we're studying or whatever. I'm going to take the precepts or whatever. And, you know, like, but another piece, just in terms of like specifically the Catholic family members, I think it's really nice, if assuming again that maybe family members they're concerned, right? They're bringing concern to you. It's wonderful to emphasize that Buddhism doesn't have gods, right? Like that it's non-theistic. Now, that's not, you know, if they look very closely, they'll be like, well, then what are all those things on the altars? And it's not that simple, but it's fine to present it that simply. That it is not, you can believe in God or not. Like it's about how you, it helps you, you know, it's about how to live your life more compassionately and skillfully, right? So I think it's fine to kind of just oversimplify a little bit in order to
help people understand that, like, you know, it doesn't, we have no competing gods. And that, like, nothing there is required, you know, that that you're not being compelled to, you know, bow to statues if you don't want to, and all that kind of stuff. Jason.
Yeah, just addressing the Catholicism thing. I come to Zen Buddhism out of Catholicism, and I was a convert to Catholicism too. So I've just kind of like worked my way down the ladder. But I come to Zen through the Catholic mystical tradition. And it's actually, as far as Christianity goes, Catholicism is almost like the gateway into Zen through the mystical tradition. I mean, if family members are concerned, I mean, you can give them a stack of books, starting with The Cloud of Unknowing, written by an anonymous 15th century monk, Thomas Merton in the 60s. He was a Trappist monk who wrote extensively and was friends with Thich Nhat Hanh before he passed. And there's a whole bunch of other monks and nuns, Alred Graham, who's written Zen Catholicism and up to contemporary times. But, you know, in Christianity and in Catholicism, you have this apophatic tradition, which is this wordless tradition of theology where you can't really say anything about God because God is just mystery. And that's, I think, very compatible with, you know, the Cloud of Unknowing, and that is very compatible with the Zen idea of nothingness and the relative and the absolute that Domio talks about all of the time. And so, you know, I mean, there are, if people that are Catholic are concerned about you practicing meditating, I know plenty of monks and nuns who sit Zazen. I mean, that's not even an issue for them. So I don't see how that, unless they're very fundamentalist Catholic, which can happen, how that's even really an issue with being Catholic.
Thank you. Leah.
Yeah, so I don't know how many months ago it was when you gave the car and the mountain metaphor, but I have used it and it's worked. So, and it would be, I don't know, it might work for a certain person in your life, it might, but I used it with my husband and he kind of went, okay, like,
you give us the metaphor.
Yeah, the metaphor is, I'm gonna do a bad job at it, but anyway, the metaphor is the mountain is up there and you don't have to drive to the top. The mountain is like spiritual enlightenment or whatever, and the mountain's there and you don't have to drive to the top, but you can. And if you want to, you could get in a car and you could drive up the mountain. And there's other people in other countries adjacent to the mountain, all driving to the top, and they're driving different cars. And some are walking and some are taking a bus, and they're all taking all these vehicles and they're heading for the top of the mountain. And in your example, you said, and it wouldn't be that useful or skillful to get out of the car and decide to take another one. But anyway, I've done that. Because, you know, you're interrupting the journey. But eventually, I like to think of it this way. The closer you get to the peak, the more you can kind of see each other. And you go, oh, okay, we're all kind of similarly heading for the same peak. And so that's... I found it to be really useful in explaining this to my husband. So, anyway, thank you.
We just have a few minutes left. No, not worth getting on to another topic. Additional. But yeah, it really depends. You know, if you're... It depends on what your family members are concerned about. I could imagine some loved ones being concerned for us that we don't believe in God. And in which case, you know, I've always thinking of like what kind of common ground can I establish? You know, what in Zen or Buddhism is kind of similar that I can share? And, you know, so I do would say we approach God differently. It's not that we don't believe in God, but we are an apophatic tradition, as somebody brought up, as opposed to a cataphatic tradition. The cataphatic traditions describe God, name God, God to tell you where God is, tell you what God wants, you know? And the apophatic says, all we can say is what he's not, or it is not, or all we can do is kind of clear away. All we can do is degunkify, and then it is revealed. But we do believe, and there's you know, that compassion is inherent in the structure of the universe, that, you know, it's not a nihilistic void. So I don't know, that might be helpful. Vin.
Yes, helps if I unmute. In dealing with Christian family members who might be concerned about the turn to the Buddhist cult, if they perceive it that way, John 14, verse 1-6, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. That's 1 and 2, I think. That is at least an entree into thinking about that in terms of scripture. My mother used to tell me that. She had a pretty ecumenical view of religion. So anyways, I'll stop talking now.
Thank you for that. That's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, and there are, as somebody brought up, there's wonderful, wonderful sources out there. Like, I think Thich Nhat Hanh collaborated on some kind of living Buddha, living Christ. Yeah, so there's like, and they say basically, you know, amongst us converts, there's like Christian Buddhists and there's Jewish Buddhists. So the Jewish tradition has its own relationship to that. And it actually, like some people says, it kind of, in many ways, they flow pretty naturally into each other and complement each other. All right, well, we call it a day. Fighting in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna parami. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And Bob, if you would.